Okay, this is the final installment today of Plateau Native Art. My name is Leah Bowie. I am curatorial staff at the Minnesota Historical Society. And I've been doing kind of these teach-ins all week about the art of the people of the Plateau region, which is where Holden Village is situated today. And today, for the finale, is Plateau Contemporary Art. It's important to recognize that regardless of what these people have been through, and we've been talking about economic collapse, we've been talking all week about the smallpox epidemic in the late 18th century and how that wiped out entire tribes on the plateau and about 90% of the plateau population generally, and how hard that was to recover from. These people are still here. They're still carrying on their traditions. And I wanted to show you some of the work that's being done these days. This is a piece by one of sort of the cadre of Plateau artists, one of like the first most famous Plateau artists. This is Joan Quitdesee Smith. She's Kootenai, Salish, and Cree. From Montana, and this is an object, very large, a mixed media installation called Trade, and in parentheses, gifts for trading land with white people. And this is an image it's bigger than this screen, even it's wider than the screen. And what it is the image of a canoe, and if the color were better, you would see sort of kind of how blood-based the palette is of this object. That's intentional. And up top, it's a little bit hard to see, are souvenirs. They're beaded souvenirs, the kind of thing that you would get at like Wisconsin Dells. They're fakey feather bonnets. They're baseball caps with Chief Wahoo emblazoned on them. They're made in China tomahawks. That kind of thing. So the intimation being that these are the gifts that we receive in exchange for our ancestral lands is this kind of mocking.
Crap.
Yeah, crap, garbage, crap. Basically. And as I said, this is an extremely large piece. It's overwhelming. It takes up like an entire gallery wall when you walk into it. It's unavoidable, which is exactly how Quitdesee Smith works. That's her MO, is making herself and her commentary on white America's interactions with Native America unavoidable. And now while this is, Plateau contemporary stuff specifically, there are a lot of themes that are nearly pan-Indian that run through contemporary Native work, simply because we have a lot of shared history with other tribes. A lot of people went through similar sort of land dispossession, loss of religion, loss of culture, those aspects, loss of economy, traditional economy. And it's reflected generally in Native culture. And this, in turn, has given birth to a kind of pan-Indian movement that started in the 40s and really gained a lot of ground by the 60s, which in turn gave birth to American Indian movement and the Red Power movement. So even though, for example, you'll see these are Yakima youngsters, in 2010 at the Yakima powwow. This woman, if you came to the class on Native beadwork in clothing, you'll notice that she's wearing an extremely traditional plateau style elk tooth dress. I mean, that's like, there's no mistaking that that's a plateau dress. This youngster, on the other hand, even though he's a plateau boy, he's wearing a type of outfit. He's what we call a fancy dancer. That is from Oklahoma. which, as you know, used to be called Indian Territory, and it was called Indian Territory because Native groups from all over the United States got shipped there. This was supposed to be where the federal government sequestered Native people, and it was the plan to ship everybody there. And then, of course, oil was discovered there. And,
so we better move everybody.
Right, so we stopped shipping people there after a while. But because so many Native groups from so many disparate places and disparate cultures were shipped to Oklahoma and rubbed shoulders with one another, because, I mean, you've got, like, the Potawatomi next to the Arapaho. I mean, people who are completely different culturally, but have been forced together. It becomes this kind of extremely dynamic melting pot for a syncretic Native culture. And that's where his regalia has come from specifically. Even the type of fan that he's using is very much a Southern Oklahoma tradition that's now danced all over the United States and even into Southern Canada. So this is one of the ways in which Native people all over the US and Canada have maintained these traditions, is via powwow, via social dances. These are not religious ceremonies. Religious ceremonies tend to be very tribe specific. It's rare that there are invitations sent out to other people. Powwow is extremely public. Anyone's invited to it. There may be certain rules, like some segments people don't want you taking photos of. You are absolutely forbidden to bring any kind of drink or drugs to a powwow. But it's a way in which people maintained their traditions, partly because the federal government didn't find the social dances terribly threatening. The religious dances, the ceremonies that took place on reservations, were cracked down upon viciously.
Pagan.
Yeah, sure. Sure, but also there are several syncretic movements, probably most famously the Ghost Dance, which was brutally cracked down upon in 1890 with the death of Sitting Bull. That the specific prophecy of the Ghost Dance was that if you danced to this dance, and if people lived the old ways, the top layer of the earth, the topsoil, would roll up and take all the white people with it. So it was very threatening to the federal government. It was in direct defiance of colonial rule. And it, by the early 20th century, mid-20th century, Native religion generally was just completely cracked down on. It started to let up by the 50s, and this kind of powwow renaissance starts to happen.
So people were still able to, there was always somebody that knew these things that could quietly pass them on to the younger. I mean, you had to have somebody had to salvage some of this for you.
Yes and no, because I mean, if you talk to some of the elders who were some of the hardcore core of like American Indian movement or any kind of similar similar anti-colonial, anti-US, anti-Canada Native groups in the 60s. Like, I'll never forget having this conversation with Gloria Cranmer Webster, who's this Kwakiutl elder from British Columbia, who's the founder of their museum up there, the Umista Cultural Center, about how we're doing it wrong. We're doing it wrong. And I mean, she's really tough. She's a tough woman, and I really appreciate her for being a culture bearer and for the fact that she did hand these ways to her people. But at the same time, you can really tell that she's disappointed in us. So tradition continues, but what other generations think of the continuance of the traditions is not always it's not always really positive. I'll hear elders talk about powwow and like how it was done in the past and stuff, and these days there are it's done in like competition a lot of the time. There are prizes for best women's traditional dancer, best men's traditional dancer, best tiny tots, that kind of thing, best golden age. And that really irks them, that there are prizes, that there's any money involved whatsoever.
But that wasn't the way it was.
It wasn't the way it was, but nevertheless, traditions that don't change die.
They needed a hook.
Yeah, and it's like I think it's really important to recognize that these are living traditions, and that living traditions are by definition elastic. They have to change. So, okay, and here are some of the early modern artists, and you'll see people first. These are the women mainly, and some men, who at first were doing, making sure that just tradition carried on. They were making the old style formal caps like this. And these are things that must be worn during ceremony on the plateau. Like, you have to have a cap or you're not properly dressed as a woman. So if these things stopped being made, that's a problem. You know, your head should be covered. You should be modest. So this is an Ida Black Eagle piece. She's passed since then. She was a Nez Perce weaver. But I mean, these are our culture bearers. This is a dress made for powwow, 1990. Very similar in style to the things that were made in the 30s. God, this color is just killing me, man.
What color is it?
Yeah, it's a blue dress, red and green beadwork.
Oh, yeah.
Bananas.
We had trouble with it last night.
Yeah.
Something wrong with this.
So what is powwow? This is a group of young women, Nez Perce women, at their powwow in Idaho. Powwow is a traditional way for distant bands and tribes to come together and socialize, which is incredibly important. I mean, in the past, what you're talking about is this is the way that young women, you know, in a band or a village of, say, 100 to 200 people, met eligible men, you know, from other related bands who were nevertheless not literally their cousins, you know? So this is how you carry on tradition, quite literally, and also how new dances spread and new forms spread. Because you come into contact very frequently with people who've been to other people's powwows. This is Michaela McKay.
Beautiful.
She's Cayuse, Walla Walla, Umatilla, and Nez Perce. Nowadays, you've probably heard the term Indian princess. I hear that term a lot, most frequently in the phrase, my great-great-grandmother was a Cherokee princess. No, she wasn't. While it's none of my business, and I make a point of not castigating people for any kind of like family stories they have about their ancestry, there is no such thing as a princess in Native America, period. Up until very recently. And nowadays, we've kind of taken that term and gone with it. And this is Michaela McKay, and she's the Cayuse Nation's princess for 2011. And what that means is that she's been recognized by her nation usually for doing some kind of very intensive social work, something that benefited the tribe. Specifically, women like this who get this title, they get granted it for a year and then pass it on. It's less beauty pageant, kind of Miss America sort of thing, but it is related to that, than it is in recognition for somebody who's a good traditional leader, essentially. That's what she's being recognized for. And normally you'll get like a beaded sash made that you wear like at powwow, you wear at treaty days, parties, you know, any kind of formal, or like the basketball tourney, you know, any kind of formal thing that you're supposed to show up at. And you wear your sash or you wear your beaded crown, and you get to do that for a year. And it's just the tribe's way of saying, like, thank you. Yeah.
I'm guessing then that person is also a role model, too.
She is, very much, yeah, yeah. And a lot of the time, the women, and it's actually rarely that there's men who are chosen for these things. I'm not really sure why, if it's the princess thing, or if it's that, generally speaking, the women really are culture bearers in our tribes. But, yeah, generally speaking, it's working with youth that really garners a lot of positive attention from the elders, specifically because Native American youth are terribly endangered. We have the, bar none, the highest suicide rate of any ethnic group in the U.S. or Canada. We have the highest poverty rate. We have per capita the highest incarceration rate. The highest rate of use of intravenous drugs. So in many regards, the prospects for Native American youth are pretty grim. So young people who go out of their way to make sure that other young people have some kind of safety net are recognized.
The discs on her body or braid or whatever, are they beaded?
No, they're enormous discs of conch shell that have come all the way up from the Gulf of Mexico.
Which would be very valuable.
They are very valuable. Difficult. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a form of currency, and it's also, it's a kind of thing that's called a gorgette a lot of the time, and it's an honor to be able to wear something like that.
So the outfit she's wearing would have been created by her family?
Probably her family for her. I'm guessing like an aunt.
It's not something that would be passed to the next.
No, princess. No, that's hers. That's hers.
She's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah, she's looking really good.
Well, no, she's beautiful as a person.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I'm sure she's a really good person. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those crowns. This is a Miss Yakima Nation crown, and at the very center of it is the Yakima Nation's logo, the tribal logo.
Would that eagle have been a symbol before U.S. influence?
Yes and no. Yes and no. It's this like bizarre sort of syncretic. It's like this. They've taken the symbols of power from both Native America and the United States and made them, aligned them, essentially, so that it's just all powerful, you know? Because, I mean, we've always looked at eagles, bald eagles and golden eagles, as the Greeks would have called them the psychopomps, the soul bearers. These are the animals that, because they fly closest to the heavens, are the bearers of our prayers to the Creator. So that's an incredibly powerful symbol right there. And then as soon as these people encountered the U.S., of course they encountered the American eagle, which is a symbol of military might, right? So this kind of symbol is very much a syncretic symbol of generalized Native power now. Okay, so ways in which, when you wear formal dress for yearly memorials of battles between Native nations and the U.S. Army, every year, mainly plateau and plains groups will do this thing where, in order to memorialize their dead from a specific battle where the cavalry usually was encountered, women and men dress up in period regalia of that time and will go to the battle site and sometimes reenact aspects of the battle. And it's a means of memorialization, but at the same time, it also keeps arts alive because new things need to be made. New regalia needs to be made for these visits. every year, I just mentioned the ghost dance, right? This oppositional syncretic religious movement that took place in the late 19th century, where the topsoil was supposed to roll up and take all the white people with it, and the bison would come back, and so would all your ancestors. This ended on December 29th, 1890, with the murder of Sitting Bull at Wounded Knee, which is a particularly famous massacre, right, in U.S. history. Every year, the Lakota, the Standing Rock Lakota, get on their horses in full regalia with eagle staffs and ride in the freezing cold to Wounded Knee in memorialization of it every year. And this is what these women are doing at Fort Vancouver for some massacre that took place there. Okay, so this is an Elsie Thomas basket, one of these people who kept coiled basketry, traditional basketry, on the plateau alive. And she was one of a handful of women who did this, maybe three or four. Nobody else was reading these things. It could easily have been lost. And yet this elder was keeping it alive. Part of what's going on there is that people, especially in the 60s, during the Red Power movement, go to their elders who are still doing the old things, still making the old art, in a way, in an attempt to reclaim what is good about being Native, having had an entire generation at least, maybe two generations, maybe three, having been told that your culture is not good enough, your language isn't good enough, your religion isn't good enough, and what we're going to do is we're going to put you in a boarding school, make you learn English, teach you how to farm, and cut your hair, which is a symbol of being in mourning in most Indian cultures. The federal government really tried to erase who we are as Native people. And yet, this prevailed. These art objects prevailed. And then by the time the 60s come around, youngsters start coming back to their elders and saying, I need to learn the old ways. Vision quests start happening again. Native religion starts to come back, and it's to the point where, like at U of M, you can take classes in Dakota and in Anishinaabe Mohin, and you can relearn your language. You can also relearn your language on your res, which is equally important. There are plenty of kids who move to the city and take classes. This is what I did. I took classes in anthropology and kind of relearned how to be Native via old ethnographies of my tribe. But people can also, at this point, go back to the res or stay on the res and relearn these things. There are programs to relearn your language, for example. This is a Nettie Kunikai basket. She's probably the most famous Klickitat weaver. She's probably the most famous plateau weaver nowadays. And beautiful objects in highly traditional style. This is a classic Klickitat basket with the kind of like sort of rubbish bin conical shape. The ears at the top completely imbricated on it. Each basket takes her maybe a year.
How big is that?
I would say. And she does commissions, if you're interested. Natalie Kirk, who was part of the revival of the twine Sally bag tradition on the plateau. Pat Courtney Gold. She's half Tlingit from Southeast Alaska and half Wasco from the Columbia River Gorge, and she makes these old-style Sally baskets, but Can you see kind of what's going on here? Something's a little different. Look at the female ancestor figure. What's happening there?
She has a baby.
She's pregnant.
How cute, how wonderful.
Yeah, which is not something that ever appears in the traditionally woven stuff. That's not something I've ever seen. But it's she's depicting our link as modern day Indians to our ancestors via these arts. In this, she's also still weaving and is commissionable. And this is one of my favorites of hers. This is Native Yuppie Couple, Sally Bag, which kind of, you know, depicts another change in Native America, and that's conspicuous consumption, I would say. So she's woven this thing with these young man and woman kind of dressed like pimps, basically dressed very flash, but not in very traditional style.
And holding hands.
Yep. Public display of affection. It's true. I didn't notice that. Very nice. He's in kind of a zoot suit, which I love.
Where do they start doing the rap on the big res?
The what?
The rap on the reservation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Tons of it. Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. Another pretty massive change, and one that I personally really like, is the breakdown of gender-based work in modern Native art. Men start to break into weaving and beadwork and other traditional womanly arts, and women start to sculpt. I happen to really like that. I think that's lovely. We, in general, Native America has always had a tradition in almost every tribe called Two-Spirit people. I don't know if you've ever heard that term. The nearest thing that we really have in the dominant culture is maybe gay men and lesbians. So not really, it's not exactly, because it's a gender distinction. Specifically, so there are special women and men who in the past would have taken on the opposite sex's role for everything. And that was okay. That was fine. And actually, these people were thought to have been singled out by the Creator as something special. So there are women who would hunt and marry other women, and there were men who would weave and marry other men. But it's not the case with this anymore. It's just a guy doing women's work at this point. And you can see what he's depicted on here is a high-voltage tower, the kind of thing that you see by the freeway in the middle of nowhere. Sally Bag. And this is one of his glass baskets. Just the colors.
Yeah.
Horrendous, but this is what this thing looks like in person. I mean, it just has this beautiful glow, but it's entirely based on traditional plateau forms. It's just in this very, very strangely modern medium. Glow glass. Yeah, tire treads. There's also a resurgence of old religious ways and the very old sculptural styles being redone a lot of the time in strange media like metal. This is Ted Palmentier's owl sculpture. It's a really early piece from 65. I'm sure he must have gone to like Institute for American Indian Arts in Santa Fe or something like that. But he's kind of approaching like the old school sculpture that we saw yesterday, that piece. Do you recognize this at all? Yeah, it's a Gaglalis, that pictograph from Thief River Falls, very famous pictograph that's now been closed off to the public because locals were taking pot shots at it with a BB gun, but. Yeah, so this is Lillian Pitt. She's a Wasco Yakima sculptor who works mainly in glass and in metal and does old forms in new media. And this is a cast crystal piece. And here's her crow standing proud. What she does primarily is she takes the old stories and makes a snapshot, basically, of them in these pieces. So she kind of does things that even traditionally you might never have seen, and sort of makes them into a traditional looking object that recalls the old stories. Joe Federson. Changer 3 vase. It's all about Transformers. Again, sorry for this crappy slide, but down here, you have this ancestor figure with the X-ray ribs, so you know immediately that there's some kind of shamanic activity being depicted in the vase. So it's Lillian Pitts leaning into the wind, which is a piece about coyote, the main trickster figure on the plateau.
How old is this woman?
I'm going to say late 60s. She's on Facebook and everything. She's a Facebook friend. She's great. So, I mean, she's very easy to get in contact with. And she's still plugging away. She's still working really hard at art. And then you get into some of what the younger people are doing on the plateau. These are up-and-coming artists. This is Greg Robinson. He's Chinook. And this is a rattle that is in extremely traditional Columbia River Gorge style. This ancestor figure, the big eyes, the headdress, the exposed rib cage. And what this is intended as is a doctor's rattle, a shaman's rattle. He's one of the most amazing and prolific plateau sculptors around today, and he's maybe 35. So we should have a good long run of his art being made.
Well, look on your slide, it's red.
It's red cedar.
It's red cedar. Oh, it's
cedar. Like what we're surrounded with. On here. I mean, these things are like absolutely sumptuous, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's nice. We can see your laptop. It's a good distance for our eyes.
Fabulous. Another ancestor figure bowl.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And this is a house panel with ancestral figure.
Also what is a house panel? What is a house panel?
A house panel is something that... So people lived in houses of extended families in the plateau, and they lived in fairly large, open area cedar houses that were constructed of cedar planks. And the houses looked pretty plain on the exterior, but once you moved inside the house, you would have a minimum of 4 beams supporting the house that were completely carved with ancestral figures looking down at you. And you would also have panels lining the house with depictions of either religious stories or generalized ancestral figures. And that's what he's doing here, is he's kind of mimicking these very old panels. Unfortunately, very few of those panels survive. We have a very vestigial sort of historical record of what those things look like. Some of them only survive still in illustrations in early anthropologists' books. So that's what he has to work with, basically, when he recreates this. He very recently recreated an entirely new traditional style plateau house in Washington State that's completely carved on the inside, and it must be a joy to see. And you can see it on his website. He has a website with all that information in it. So by the 1970s, non-natives are also starting to reproduce native style art, mainly having learned from native masters. This is Adam McIsaac. He's Euro-American. He's a friend of mine. He's a good guy. Chinookan style coyote headdress. This is really a fascinating thing to me because you would think that most Native people would react to this like this is the final blow, right? Like they're taking our art. They're learning how to reproduce, like our last vestige of culture. I have never heard another Indian person say anything bad about white folks learning the art. It's been overwhelmingly positive. And that's something I'm really curious about because a lot of the time, frankly, if we get the opportunity to malign white people, we'll take it. You know, because there's a lot of anger still. I've never heard Native artists malign white artists who are working in Native styles so long as they're doing it well. And Adam McIsaac is a stunning example of somebody who does it well to the point where he can speak Chinook jargon. He's good at it. He's learned the language. I mean, he's very much internalized the culture without ever trying to say that he is Native. So he has a lot of respect in the plateau. This is David Franklin, another non-native artist who's working in the Chinook style. And this is this absolutely enormous plaque called Chinook and Sunset. You can see it's almost like a flattened bowl form, those traditional bowls that we've been looking at during the week. Yeah, so this is Jean Quick to C. Smith, if you can see the actual color of the robe. And she's somebody who went to art school. And a lot of Indian artists, the Institute for American Indian Arts is established in Santa Fe in the 60s, I believe, and a lot of Native artists start going to art school. And what they're doing there is they are learning new media, how to manipulate new media for the purpose of making new Native art. So they're using forms that were never used before, like oil paint on canvas, and making something uniquely modern and Indian. This is a James Lavador. It's an oil painting, and he paints about the land just over and over and over again, like these huge Anselm Kiefer type landscape paintings of the plateau. This is Kevin Peters, image of an imaginary ancestor by the name of Walk Softly and carries a large hatchet. Yes, and that's exactly who he's riffing off of. I think this is an image of, you know, you have your state politicians, we have them too. You know, here's an oil painting, an oil portrait of a state politician. And finally, this is Lillian Pitt going full circle. She's made an intaglio etching called Living with the Ancient Stories. So, completely new form. And what is it? It's a pictograph of the old stories. And that's it.
You know, it makes sense that they would look to new medium. If these mediums had been available 200 years ago, your people would have used them.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
They used what they had and created beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Why not go on to new stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's partly just the fact that the economy, I keep harping on the new economy, but the economy has changed, and it's necessary at this point for artists, if you're going to be able to support yourself, to be able to sell things. So that's part of the, I think, the impetus towards new media as well, is something that's more saleable in a Western market. So they're doing it for that reason. They're also just doing it because pure curiosity, just joy in making something new.
Do you have any questions?
I'm really glad you talked about non-native artists because, you know, who hasn't been on a trip and been in a gallery or somewhere and you see the picture of the artist and it's, you know, Indian work and you can't make sense of the two. And so it's good to hear that that isn't, it feels like kind of wrong in a way. And so it's good to hear that in the art world, at least as you know, what you run into, it hasn't been an issue.
And I'm fascinated.
I am too.
Especially because there's money involved.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know? And there doesn't seem to be any kind of backlash.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a tremendous number of non-native artists working in specifically the Northwest Coast style, like totem poles, like Dwayne Pasco, who's wide, or Bill Holm, or Robin Wright, my thesis advisor. These are all widely lauded artists of Euro-American descent.
Mm-hmm.
And technically, they're competing.
I wonder if it has to do with just the creative spirit. You know, that artists are just unique people and they don't...
Artists fit, are strange.
They don't fit...
It's true.
They don't fit in a box.
It's true.
Know? And so that might have something to do with it.
It might have something to do with it.
That's
true.
Yeah, there's also respect given because some of these art forms were had new life breathed into them on occasion by white folks.
Mm-hmm.
Like Bill Holm, who was my thesis advisor's thesis advisor, went up to a place in the Tsimshian territory in the northern northwest coast called Ksan and opened a school
mm-hmm.
up there after he taught himself Northwest Coast form line. And he taught this whole generation of Tsimshian artists how to draw again.
That's huge.
You know? Like Ken Mowat and a bunch of like just huge names, Terry Starr from up there. And he taught them how to draw again, and they went on and they taught their own native students how to draw. So, and people remember that,
mm-hmm.
you know? So
mm-hmm. yeah.
that may have something to do with that
mm-hmm.
as well, like just leave off, you know, let them work. I don't know. Any other questions?
I was curious about
yeah.
music.
Yeah.
I know it wasn't the main, it wasn't really what you were focusing on, but Isaiah loves guitar, and he was doing a they have to do, at their elementary school, a Native American project.
Huh.
And he chose to do it on traditional contemporary music in the Upper Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And he found a band that was combining really, I guess, really popular band. There's like Native American awards, music awards. And they combine sort of punk and traditional song, and I thought that was interesting.
Do you know the name?
I can't remember. He might remember the name of the band.
There's a bunch of bands. The one that I like the best is a Tsimshian black metal group that takes like the old ceremonial flutes and combines it with Europe, like Norwegian black metal, which is very loud, and they growl in Tsimshian too over the lyrics, and they're great.
So that's the, I just wanted to ask about that dynamic and see what you would have to say about it, because I thought it was pretty fascinating when he was researching this band and the way they were mixing, like you're just saying, mixing those genres.
Yeah, there are a lot of rock and blues bands that are indigenous out there. There are also more kind of straightforward powwow drums, like Northern Cree or Black Lodge singers that you can see on the powwow trail all the time. I mean, they're huge names. And they generally do very traditional music in their own language, but occasionally sing in English.
Yeah, there are a lot of mixes. And then there's people like Carlos Nakai, who does like Navajo flute music, but for a Western audience as well. And then there's Brent Michael Davis, who's a guy in the Twin Cities who does classical symphonies. He writes classical symphonies. And he's Anishinaabe, I think.
There was a group at Bumbershoot last year that were playing sort of powwow the drums, and but then the lyrics that they were doing were just super modern, and it was just such an interesting mix. It was about their families, and they were going to get in trouble with their wives on things, and it was really fun. It's like what you walk up to them thinking you're going to hear something, and it's different. It was.
Northern Cree has a song about getting in trouble on Facebook. Well, I mean, you can listen to it on YouTube, you know, it's out there, but...
It was cool.
Is there any resentment among Native artists that they have to either... that they have to address tradition so obviously with their work, either reject it or build on it or etc.?
I think that there was, like in the 70s, especially. I think people have kind of moved beyond that. There are plenty of Native artists out there who don't particularly touch on being Indian in their work. You know, it's more sort of, you know, like clearly influenced by Francis Bacon or something like that. It has nothing to do with being Navajo or Arapaho or anything else. But in terms of marketability, a lot of the time you get an edge up by exhibiting yourself as a Native artist, but it definitely constrains what you can do. But yeah, that's a problem. That's definitely a problem. I'm sure that African American painters and sculptors face much the same issue. Yeah.
You talked about the ghost dance. What about sun dances? Do the people here do in this area do sun dances? Or?
No. That's something that you might find on the extreme eastern plateau as it abuts plains culture, but that's plains. Sun dance is really a plains thing, which still continues. I don't know if you know the Sundance. It's the world renewal ceremony on the plains. And actually, they just happened 2 weekends ago in Native America. Most of them just happened, at least in, the ones in South Dakota happened two weekends ago. A friend of mine attended one. So they're definitely still around. And more people are still doing them. I have a good friend, actually, who has the scars from where you hang from the world tree during Sundance. He has these big scars and the hooks getting blown out from his chest. It's the ultimate sacrifice to the creator, basically, is doing that.
The Blackfoot, this is a while ago. Maybe 15 years ago, they were doing one.
They're definitely a Western Plains group, though they're not quite plateau. But no, it's not really something people do here. Any other questions? Yeah.
I missed your prior classes, and I'm gathering that this plateau is a large area.
It is.
Because, I mean, you were talking about Alaska all the way to...
No, not Alaska. That's Northwest Coast.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I can show you.
So just up to Vancouver.
Okay.
Oh, that's good.
So that's the plateau. Right here.
What states? So Washington goes into British Columbia.
Idaho, British Columbia, Oregon, the extreme northeast of California.
Okay.
Yeah, it's actually one of the smaller culture areas of North America, but nevertheless is huge.
Do you have any difficulty classifying, like, for instance, Lillian Pitt, Warm Springs, lives in Portland,
mm-hmm.
she watches down the Columbia River,
mm-hmm.
fires her ceramic works in Astoria, like, you know, these regions are a lot less defined than maybe, yeah, I mean, to these categories of plateau, etc.
Well, I mean, yeah, they're based on the elements of culture present, right? Like the traditional food staples, traditional religious stories, traditional life ways, that type of thing. She's part of that, regardless of the fact that she's a modern artist. And her work is completely suffused with those elements.
No, I'm a friend of Lillian's.
That's all. She's a great lady.
Work, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, she's a modern artist, she's a modern American artist, but she's also a modern plateau artist. I don't think there's any getting around that.
I wonder if it isn't sort of like when we meet people in the United States, it's not that uncommon to say when you're getting to know someone, well, where were you born? Or, you know, where do your relatives live? And so there's a certain, you learn a little something just by that connection.
This is, you know, technically, you can't establish treaties legally unless they are between nations. So this is kind of even beyond ethnicity. These are separate nations within the United States. And I mean, that's a concrete legal distinction. So there's that aspect, too, that each of us, if you're native, you have citizenship in a nation that's not just the United States, in whatever your native nation is, too. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.